You're listening to the Great Coaches Podcast.
Hi everyone, Paul here, and just a quick message from me to let you know that if you are looking to improve the performance of your team, no matter whether it is a work, sporting or community one, then we've developed some tools to help. On the website, you will find our Thriving Teams Diagnostic, which uses insights from the more than 200 great coaches we have interviewed to challenge you with a series of questions to help you understand how your team is performing. It's free and only takes a few minutes to complete. If you'd like to know more, you can check out our website, thegreatcoachespodcast.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast.
To me, being perfect is not about that scoreboard out there.
This is a chance of a lifetime.
When you can understand the person, you can then work towards a common goal.
We are all on the same team.
Know your role and do it to the best of your ability.
Focus on the fundamentals. We've gone over time and time again.
Your defense has got to be better.
Leave no doubt tonight.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
Hello and welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast. My name is Paul Barnett, and this week we continue our exploration of thriving teams with a focus on the idea of cohesion within a team. And to do that, Eric and I are joined by Ben Darwin. Ben is a former Australian rugby union player who represented his country 28 times. He retired at the age of 27 after a neck injury and moved into coaching before co-founding Gainline Analytics, a company that uses empirical analysis to understand the way professional sports teams work and succeed with each other. This is one of the more fascinating interviews we've had on the podcast because of the challenging views he has on the traditional drivers of success. Some of the key highlights from the discussion are Ben's idea that small groups can be highly effective, and the example he gives from military and history to show that it is the cohesion of your team, not the size of the talent pool you pull from, that is key to success. His description of cohesion as understanding between the component parts of a team, and that this understanding is much more predictive of outcomes than the individual skill of the athletes or team members, and how effective cultures have normative behaviours that are established over time, are harder to change, and can be learnt more easily across the components of a team. And just before we go to the interview, today's podcast is brought to you by the Macquarie University Business School's MBA program. Designed to empower, challenge, and transform, the Macquarie MBA gives you the business skills and knowledge you need to succeed in an evolving global economy. The program bridges the gap between theory and real-world application, bringing together world-leading professors, executives, and industry partners to teach you how business can be used for good. I have just started working with the team at Macquarie on some projects and can attest to the quality of the people and material. To find out more, search for Macquarie University Business School's MBA. And now please enjoy our interview with Ben Darwin.
You're listening to the Great Coaches Podcast.
Ben Darwin, hello and welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast.
G'day, Paul. G'day, Eric. Nice to see you.
And of course, I'm here with my colleague, Professor Eric Knight. Eric, how are you going?
I'm well, Paul. Great to be talking to Ben today.
It is. And Ben, we always start with a really simple question before we get into the hard ones. Where are you today and what have you been up to so far?
Okay, so I'm in Melbourne. I have four kids and a wife, so I'm happy to be out of the house because school holidays are coming up. I've been looking at NFL data this morning and trying to understand the policies of the New York Jets and why they have been so horrible for the last 25 years, and then organising some more speaking stuff.
That's an interesting place to start. So any insights you can share there about the Jets before we get into it?
It's going to be complex, but fundamentally, when you have large populations that support clubs that have a long history, particularly early history, then people want to be able to replicate that success again. Obviously, they were the first AFC team to sort of win the Super Bowl. And so there was this sort of sense that if you've had like Richmond in the AFL, if you've been successful previously, you want to get back there as quickly as you can. And so the Jets fans are unbelievably impatient and unbelievably fickle. And there's a lot of them, with always places large amounts of pressure on the owner to act fast and generally fail repetitively.
Well, let's get into the interview then, because I think we're going to get under the skin of what it's like to build a team, why some fail and why some succeed. But Ben, I wanted to start by talking a little bit about your playing career before we get into the work you do around analytics and understanding team dynamics. I mean, you've represented your country and you've represented many representative teams along the way, and you've coached, you've been a head coach too. And when you reflect back on your journey through these teams, I want to ask you about this sense of belonging that you had in these teams and what you found that the best ones did to create it.
Probably the two teams that have been the most successful that I've been a part of, I probably felt the least level of belonging within them, particularly in the early stages. So when I joined the Brumbies, I was 20 or 21, and I was told, change or go. If you don't fix your behavior, you're gone. And so that was pretty brutal, and I had a couple of years there of pretty hard work. But for me, it was like that was a closed shop, and it was I wanted to join that closed shop, and I had to work really, really hard. Whereas, you know, I've had this sort of discussion in the last couple of days, interestingly, is that really poorly built teams, they'll fundamentally welcome you as a savior, let you do as you want, but the problem is you don't make them any better, you just make them worse. The other was a team called Suntory in Japan I coached at, and it was a very similar scenario, a bunch of guys who'd been at university together, very closed shop, very hard to kind of break into that group, and there was a high level of mistrust of outsiders, and they were... We went through the entire season undefeated, and then I was fired at the end of the year because they didn't feel like I was what they needed.
So, Ben, just talking a little bit then about those teams, I mean, you've commented about, you know, the changing makeup of people playing rugby in Australia, and this has obviously been a big conversation in Australia. Can you say something about, you know, how that trend has played out over the last couple of years and what you think that means in terms of creating the right sort of environment for teams to be successful?
I mean, fundamentally, you're talking about the economic migration that's taken place, particularly off the Pacific Islands. I mean, New Zealand's used that to a great advantage for them over the previous period of time. But I think the one thing that we do see is it's about understanding people's priorities. So a lot of guys off the Pacific Islanders, for example, are supporting large amounts of people. And so the challenge with that is that once then given an opportunity for greater, particularly given the COLPAC agreement, I don't know if you guys are aware of the COLPAC agreement, means that basically Samoans, South Africans, Pacific Islanders can play in Europe and be regarded as a local, is that you've got that kind of pull overseas. And so that will be very much affected by, for example, the strength of the pound, strength of the euro, and those kind of needs. And it's very hard to get a sense of community for those guys. You know, when they're joining clubs, and also too is they've got these different sets of priorities. I'm not a big believer in people not being loyal or disloyal. There's just different types of loyalty. Whereas when you're a young Anglo-Saxon male with two or three families and you come from a wealthy background, that's a different set of priorities that you need to sort of absorb and to be comfortable with. And so you're less likely, for example, to go to Europe. So that's kind of probably destabilized Australian rugby to a certain extent. But again, it's not about qualities of individuals or qualities of good or bad decisions. It's just different decisions get made.
So how do you build those groups? I mean, you talked about in-groups, out-groups, different kind of lines, communities that people are part of. I mean, how do you begin to center that on the team and the performance of that team?
I think the fundamentals is you're not there to like each other. You're not there to get on. You're not there to focus on anything else other than the success of the team. So basically it comes down to what is my role? What is your role? Accurate. I remember talking to some guys at NAB, and they said they were trying to – NAB had built this system where they were all trying to – they had a choir to make everyone get on great. And they said it was great. You know, we'd sing together and we'd come back on Tuesday and Dave's still doing the reports wrong and I wanted to punch his face in. So it's like the focus really has to be on alignment of understanding between the component parts of the team, alignment to system, alignment to role. And then once you start to get that clarity, the rest actually takes care of itself, the social, psychological safety, trust, all that sort of stuff. It just comes as a byproduct of that. If you focus on the other stuff first, it just keeps butting up against the system.
Ben, I want to ask you about this alignment and psychological safety and those things, but just a little bit more context actually into you and where you've come from. Because in preparing for today, I've read a lot of the articles you've given before, and you talk about your mum and the fact that she's got a master's in ancient history and archaeology, and that it did shape your thoughts on team dynamics. Could you tell us a little bit about those conversations around the dinner table and how they influenced you?
Well, I think beginning is when we first started looking at the research, we couldn't find any research on sport, on cohesion or portability of talent. So we first went to Groysberg, who's at Harvard Business School. He was looking at, you know, portability of talent between stockbroking firms. And as we sort of went along, we basically sucked up every other piece of research we could possibly get access to on shared experience, what we call purity of experience, change of environments, Lencioni, all that stuff, you know, psychological safety, the Aristotle Project, all these kind of ideas around teams working together. And then I went to my mum and said, well, what is there in terms of military history? And we'd found a lot of stuff on military history, but mostly modern military history around, you know, continuity of environment. But then I started talking more about like empires and how, you know, different empires, you go out and you have different armies join up. You know, the Roman Empire was a group of different armies with different levels of loyalty, different levels of cohesion. And there was a particular comment made by Bill Pulver at one stage when he said, you know, you can't shrink yourself to success. And I fundamentally completely disagree with that statement. In fact, the history of sport is, and the history of military is fundamentally shrinking yourself to success. And growth is the enemy of understanding, being the sort of easiest component. And my mum said, Jesus, obviously Bill's, I don't think she said Jesus, he said, obviously Bill's never had any understanding of military history. And particularly, you know, she started talking about the Spartans and, you know, small groups, highly effective, and elite. And that's the thing is with sport is it's not 50 on 100. It's 13 against 13. It's 10 on 10. So the individual strength of those guys is not that, is reasonably important, but nowhere near that much. But the size of the country, the mass from which they come, really has a very small impact on performance. It's really about the level of understanding between those component parts. Now, when you have large military forces like the US, you know, the US basically runs off a policy of we have to have a 10-to-1 advantage over the opposition because they understand they have a complete lack of cohesion because of their size. So when you put 10 of them up against 10 of a very highly cohesive army, and my brother-in-law's My brother's father-in-law is actually a rear admiral in the Portuguese Navy. He talked a lot about when they were up against the British, because they had a lot more continuity with a smaller Navy, they would tear them apart in exercises. So just basically trying to, like I said, suck up everything I can, and that included military history through my mum.
Ben, can you just dive a little deeper then into team cohesion? How do you define it? What is it? How do you know it when you see it?
The thing is, for me, is you don't know it when you see it, but you can see it in the numbers. So what I'm focused on is an objective way to measure the understanding between people. In the simple terms, we talk about interpersonal understanding. You know, how many times have I played with you? How many times have I done it in this position? How many times have we played in this system? How many times have I played against you? How many times have we done these things in this way? So we also talk about positional understanding, interpersonal understanding, system understanding, so a way of doing something, and then size of a team. So a small team will learn to do something faster than a big team, like in the military, or a basketball team will learn to play together faster, and they'll do certain things more quickly. So teams in generally in 180-degree sports, invasive sports, will actually learn to attack faster than they learn to defend. And you can see that measurably is that new teams are poor, always much poorer defensively. It takes time for them to learn to function as a group, as an amorphous mass, so to speak. And so what we're just basically trying to do is to measure those components and see how that affects performance. And so the way I describe the work is it's the understanding of understanding. The level of understanding between the component parts of a team is much more predictive of outcome than the individual skill. Now, if I was to give it to, as a scenario, and sometimes I give this to make it pretty easy to understand, if you took the Bryan brothers, who are identical twins, they play tennis together, they're excellent. They were very successful, but they weren't amazingly individual skilled. Now, you can't basically get more cohesive than identical twins, you know, just that, all that time in the backyard together. So if you put those two up against Nadal and Federer in doubles, the first game would the Bryan brothers would generally win. The question is, how many games would it take Nadal and Federer to beat them? That's cohesion analytics. How long would it take their skill and their adaptation to system to playing in doubles, to playing with someone else, to playing with someone else's system? How long would it take them to beat them if they could at all? And then once you can start to understand that, you can start to say, right, we have a team. It needs to perform by this point. Therefore, this is how we'll build it. This is the level of change we can make inside of that context to perform. So sometimes we'll get approached by a club that's got 10 weeks to win a game. And then sometimes we'll say to a club will say to us or a country, we have 5 years to win a title. So they're two different, completely different scenarios. And you can work each of those with different contexts and measures.
And Ben, does that work extend to non-sporting teams?
Well, like I said, all the research comes out of of non-sporting environments. We're just applying basically HR data and military data and hospital data to sport, and just found it was much more effective at measuring sport, measuring the causality of success rather than form-based modeling. And most predictive models are based on form, which was great, but it's really not of any interest because it doesn't get to the heart of the how they're performing or why they're performing particularly well or poorly. I work with a military organization I can't talk about. We work with a team in Formula One, for example. We work with football teams, rugby union teams, work with a farming company. I've done work with banks, financial services. It's all the same stuff. It's just everything's built certain ways and the component parts are different and different systems make an impact. We've done a lot of work with Platinum Asset Management and a guy called Kerr Nelson, and just hammered Kerr for hours about his experiences. And probably the most rewarding was sitting down with Kerr and telling him sort of the story about you know, CEOs and their inability to transfer between organizations and perform well. And he just started laughing and said, and I said, well, why are you laughing? He said, because I've seen this firsthand. So everyone we speak to, the overwhelming response they give us is, what you're telling me is what I've always felt, but no one's ever put this into a number.
Could I go from the numbers to sort of look a little bit more inside? And I'm wondering, you may not have researched it, but I'm interested to hear your thoughts on the mental processes that people are experiencing that make cohesion such a powerful force.
Well, fundamentally, it's about two components of learning versus unlearning. So my son is autistic, and I remember talking to his doctor, and he was talking about people cannot take on new information under stress. The brain's just not capable. And you cannot recall new information the way that memories lay down under duress. So we would find, for example, England in rugby under fatigue after 30 minutes are the worst defensive team in the world. because they're all playing for different clubs. They come in, they're trying to adapt to that new system. And so we try to take learning like that and say, okay, well, what happens when teams do come under fatigue, or what happens when they're brought in and they do struggle? So I would say, you know, in terms of the mental process, its ambiguity is so pernicious in its nature. If I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be doing in a certain situation, it's like doing an exam, an English exam, and just before you walk in, I say, by the way, Paul is in German, right? Like that's how the West Tigers work, basically. They're changing things on the run all the time. Or everybody in your division has never used this CRM before. In fact, they've been using a different CRM, and they're expecting to hit the same outcomes as they were using a system they used for 10 years. It's just not possible. And so that creates stress. But stress, I believe, is an outcome of ambiguity, of not being sure. What's really funny about it is people say things like, oh, and they'll talk about a low cohesion team, and they'll say there's no pride in the jersey, or they just don't want it enough. Like, that's not my experience of sport at all. Everybody wants it just as much as the other guy. It's fundamentally your system up against their system under duress, and it's how quickly you can learn. And so what I would say, the answer to that mental processes component is, it's what you don't have to remember. It's what makes you win. If I know the plays inherently and I'll do them without thinking, because you have to do that a lot of the time in performance, you have to be able to act without thinking, is that the more you've done so you don't have to think, the easier it is. And so for those people who are performing in high cohesion environments, the level of clarity is remarkable. For people in low cohesion environments, it's just a complete shit show of panic and not knowing. And it's like you get people to drive on the wrong side of the road. Like, what do you have to do? You have to remember all the time, the cognitive load of remembering not to drive on the left-hand side of the road or right-hand side of the road is really, really high. That's why, you know, people get buses all the time in London as tourists, because everyone looks left, right? Mm-hmm. So it's about what you don't have to think about.
So just building on that, Ben, and sort of, you know, trying to pull out a couple or more insights and actions in building these teams. I mean, if you think about what you're talking about with team cohesion as a measure of understanding between people, you know, what we might think of as that connection, you know, you talked about under duress, how do you make decisions, and clarity helps, helps cohere the team and connect the team at that point. What else helps? What else are the things that help people connect better?
I mean, if I talk to somebody who's a leader and they're coming in and they've been given a mandate to build success, a CEO has been brought in from a competitor to come in, I'd always say the first thing you need to think about is, what do you actually need to change versus want to change? Because most of the time people make it an easier environment for them, but understanding the ramifications of that change is going to be a large level of underperformance into the environment. So basically forgetting what you think is going to be successful for you because it was somewhere else, and saying, okay, what's going to make this place successful? And this, and another part that we look at quite a lot is what we call attribution bias, which is we overly attribute the performance of the individual to their skill, not the environment they're going into. So in rugby league, Darren Lockyer's first test was terrible because he'd never played with anybody in that spine. Everyone's saying he's a terrible player, or Wayne Bennett coaching of the Newcastle Knights. But if you actually take the measurable level of cohesion, they weren't underperforming at all. They were performing exactly as they should. So if somebody is underperforming, they may not actually be underperforming at all. It's actually just us overly attributing their success or failure to them rather than the situation. And then any other forms of change, like understanding there's going to be people who've been somewhere for 30 years and a change for them will have a much higher level of influence, a much greater driver of underperformance than somebody who's just a kid who's just come straight out of uni. You've only been there a year. So for them, the unlearning is much easier than the learning. And so once you can start to understand that context, you can start to understand, okay, what do I actually want to change here? Who do I want to hold faith in? And quite interestingly, Kerr actually told me a story that after that conversation we'd had. And he said, the next day I had a guy come in and do the worst report he's ever had in the history of the organization. And I thought, no, I'm just going to hold off 1 week. He said, go back, do it again, do it this way. Came back, it was a bit better, and ended up performing very, very well. But we oftentimes panic in that first poor performance and go, oh, let's just get rid of him.
Can I pick up on this idea then around learning and unlearning? Because another theory that I've heard you talk about is that a club focused on internal development, and it could be an organization too that's growing its own talent, it has more cohesion than a club, as perhaps you pointed out just in your last answer with West, that is trying to bring in external development all the time. You know, they're trying to buy it in and develop it up. Could you tell us how a non-sporting team would apply this insight?
If you look at, for example, the medical industry, there's a reason they don't allow certain people with maybe, you know, maybe it's controversial, but they don't just, if you get a medical degree anywhere in the world, you can't come to Australia and function straight off the bat. And that's there for a reason. It's there because everyone's going to learn in different ways. So I think that basically it's about understanding what is the way in this, which this person has learned to do this job and how much does it differentiate between us and ourselves. So that's a level of system differential, but you've also got interpersonal understanding is you grow. If you develop from within, these young guys come through and they learn the system. They learn the way the club plays. Or if you're growing up in the Australian medical system, you're learning the way in which we do certain surgeries. I remember when my wife gave birth to our second child in Japan, a woman jumped on top of her and tried to push her out through the stomach. And we had some friends who were nurses and like, we haven't done that in Australia since the 60s. And they're like, well, that's how they do it over there. So there's just all these sort of system changes that take place is, and I'm not sure if I'm particularly answering this question very well, but the internal development allows the interpersonal understanding to grow and to work inside that system. But you have to remain, you have to allow continuity of system to take place. You look a lot, so Australian gymnastics, for example, constantly having different coaches come in, you know, let's go the Ukraine way, let's go the American way, let's go the Chinese way. And so internal development is only going to work if you hold to continuity of system, continuity of environment.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And I guess this is where stability becomes such a key driver.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with stability is it grows slowly and it's destroyed quickly. It's like a house, right? You can knock over a house in 3 minutes if you really want to give it an effort. We saw a club in the NRL, they dropped in their cohesion 70% in a week, right? But to get that back would take 7 years, 10 years. It's a long time. Understanding grows slowly but can be destroyed fast.
So, Ben, can you build on that to help differentiate between the idea of cohesion in a team and the culture of a team? How are those two ideas different? What comes first? How do they interact? Can you just speak a little bit to that?
Well, what do you believe culture to be, Eric? That'd be my first question.
I suppose behaviours, systems, routines, ways of reacting to,
We just try to break this down into basically what we might call normative behaviours. So normative behaviours, when we do a line out, this is how we lift. When we deliver this product, this is the things we say. When you are an environment that where people have been together for an extended period of time, they start to develop the same normative behaviours, both good and bad. So if you have an environment where you have chaos, you just don't have any normative behaviours. It's every man for himself. It's a refugee camp, so to speak. It's just everyone acting in their own self-interest. You could call that a culture, but I just try to bring it down to, as you say, just a set of behaviors get developed over time. Now, some people also say good culture versus bad culture. I don't really understand what that means because, like, I think I've mentioned my thing, like Enron was regarded as the best place to work in the US at one stage, just before things went pear-shaped when they were behaving terribly. But one person's good behavior is also another person's brilliant behavior. You know, if you've grown up in a family of criminals and the mafia your entire life, the guy who goes to the cops is the enemy. He's the cancer. He's the person doing the wrong thing. So I try to move away from good versus bad. It's simply a case of continuity of environment increases the level of understanding between the component parts, but also too is you get normative behaviors that are established over time, and those normative behaviors become more, you know, easy to learn between those component parts, but also harder to change. So if you then get somebody who wants to come in and change that environment, you tend to get an underperformance because they're trying to adapt to the new system.
So what does that mean then, Ben, if there's someone listening who, you know, is a leader of a team and they want to improve normative behaviors, where do they start? How do you think about that?
I think the biggest thing is what is it that we actually, what are the behaviors we need in order to be successful? Begin with that first. So if it's in rugby, we need to be able to defend together well for 80 minutes, only allow 13 points a game. If you want to give it a KPI. Okay, well, how do we do that? Okay, we need to be able to move so we don't have to look at each other in order to build understanding. So we need to have policies and processes that come innate to us. And I think that none of this happens quickly. You say, right, we are at a, you know, I know that a team that has been thrown together in the first year is going to allow probably 30 points a game. And there's really nothing anybody can do about that. But maybe we could get to 25 if we spend the entire time thinking about defense. Now, we know that expansion teams struggle on defense the most. So I'd be focusing in that scenario on defense more than anything else. Attack can wait. You know, it's actually easier and quicker to build understanding in attack. So let's spend 70% of our time in defense and then let's focus on that. So if you can begin to understand what are the things that are the hardest for us to learn as a group, that becomes a priority. And then you work your way out from there. But also, too, is you need to understand what skill sets do our people already have? What do they need to learn? What do they need to unlearn in order to build that understanding and to hit the level of effectiveness as fast as we can? And no team building exercises would be my advice. Don't climb any mountains together. Don't go. I remember talking to a company, they're doing a merger, and they said, oh, the merger is going to be fine because we're organizing a scavenger hunt. And I'm like, not going to help anything. So it's focusing on how do we do our job? Where do we do our job? When do we do our job? You know, how do we build this understanding as fast as humanly possible? Not focus on liking each other. That'll come with time.
Ben, I'm the corporate relic in this conversation. And the companies I've been part of have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions, doing the annual Towers Watson survey, which is a global company that looks at culture. Sometimes they call that engagement. And you get a whole pile of reports and benchmarks out of it that are useful about thinking about the things you'll do differently next year. But I can't remember there being a KPI around cohesion, understanding. But it's got to be easier than that. You just mentioned KPIs there. There must be a way, there must be something you can be looking at each month without looking at the analytics that you guys have got to understand how your cohesion is coming along.
Well, no offense, Paul, but it's not exactly in my interest to tell you, is it? if we're the only company in the world doing it, why would I tell you what you could do? No, absolutely. But culture is fundamentally an outcome. Behaviors are an outcome. 360 reviews are an outcome. Stealing is an outcome. It's an outcome of the way in which the place was put together. And Eric, like one of my experiences I've had, we've tried to do a lot of stuff with universities, for example, a lot of conversations. And the overwhelming thing it's kept coming back to is, well, when are you going to publish? How do we publish? Because, and I'd say, well, and I'd go back to my mum, it's like, I just want to work with these guys. I just want to meet good students. We just want to focus on the research. She said, no, but that's how they're funded. The funding is, you know, maybe this is a little bit older, but this is sort of 4 or 5 years ago, is it kept coming back to everything has to be about the publishing. So if you build an organization with certain rewards and certain points of view, it's going to act in certain ways. The way I describe it is if you go and live in a small town, people are, by the nature of the small town, able to say hi to each other. They're more trusting of each other. They act in a certain way in small towns. They shun outsiders. And so that is simply a geographic driver of behavior. If you take one of the people from the small towns and you move them to New York, they're going to start acting differently. They don't say hi to everybody. They're not as trusting as everybody. So that is the core driver of their behavior. So that, again, is a geographic population issue. So sometimes a lot of the behaviors and the cultures are going to be inbuilt to certain industries. You look at the financial services with the Royal Commission the last couple of years. People have been acting based on how they're rewarded, and some say poorly, some say acting brilliantly, some say in the interest of the shareholder, whatever it might be. You set things up in a certain way, they'll do a certain set of things.
I can see Eric thinking about what to challenge you with on can we publish or not. But before perhaps he jumps in, I want to ask a follow-up, Ben. Can cohesion stifle innovation?
If you are, I mean, again, this is all going to depend on where you're at comparatively to everybody else. But I think once you start to look at if you've been doing something a certain way for a period of time and you have not been evolving, you have to keep evolving all the time. You have to keep improving. But generally, when you do something 1,000 times, you play guitar 1,000 times, you sharpen a sword, you'll get better at it as you go. If you don't improve, there's something wrong, and you don't evolve the systems that you have. I think what tends to divert companies a lot of the time is like fighting for who's responsible or fighting for power. That stops them from improving. But what I would say is that if you look at, you know, I looked at ice skating, for example, the best pairings of all time in ice dancing and pairs figure skating, because they had continuity of their people, they were able to adapt to new programs all the time. Like Torvald and Dean did Bolero, they moved on to another one. So they were able to constantly move between different programs, but they had continuity of your environment. If you change partners in ice skating, in ice dancing in particular, which has a much greater level of cohesion required, I don't think anyone's ever won a gold medal ever and change ice and change partners. They win a gold medal, never change and won again, because it's just that hard to kind of deal with the level of change. But it's, you know, I look at Manchester United under Sir Alex Ferguson, and then Moyes comes in and says, right, we're going to play the Everton way. And those guys underperformed because they were so used to playing together in that way for Man U that it was almost too late for them. They were like 28, 29 years of age. Mm. So Moyes' response to that was, right, I'm going to get everyone out, clean them out. Well, now the cohesion drops and the understanding drops. Now they're importing play. And, you know, Man United's never, I'm not saying this is entirely Moyes' fault, but Man United in that moment dropped in their cohesion level by 40%, and they've never been the same since. They've never been near that level of success that they've had. So oftentimes a change of system using their cohesion against them will create a level of underperformance, will then create greater levels of change, greater levels of turnover. I mean, that's AMP basically from 96 to now, right? Just constant chaos / you know, acquisitions / turnover creates a bigger problem. Next group in, that'll fix it, makes it worse. Off it goes.
Well, so it's been just closing out for me and thinking about this in terms of, you know, if I'm a chairperson, board of director of a company, and I'm thinking about succession planning, for example, I mean, how do I think about the choice between developing internal talent inside those organizations to come through as a CEO versus, you know, when does it make sense to go to an external CEO? I mean, that principle applies at different levels of the organization, but I'm just interested in how organizations should think about the trade-off in those choices from your models.
I think what we find is that you cannot compare internal to external in terms of the level of skill. First of all, you know, the external is always going to hide all their faults. You know the faults of the internal, you know, person. Secondly, that an internal perhaps might be 30% less skillful, but will be 50% more effective. So you can't, it's not like for like. You don't say this guy's a Harvard graduate, he's fantastic, but he might have a whole bunch of impacts on the way that he comes in and tries to make things better, or he might only stay for 2 years. So you don't compare the like for like. Secondly, and I've seen this quite a bit, is that they'll go with the internal client and that doesn't work. So they throw out the baby with the bathwater. And so they'll say, right, I'm going to, now that's not going to work. I'm going to go again, but with somebody externally. Now, the problem isn't so much that, it's the amount of turnover you get when you bring the external person in. If that person comes in and they change everything to their own system, they might actually perform absolutely brilliantly. But 2 years later, you've had a turnover of 70% and the whole place is over. I've seen that quite a bit with a coach. A guy will come in, buy everything, they win a title. 2 years later, they're all gone, because why would they stay? Because they're at their third club already, right? So it's, you cannot compare the internal to the external, but it's also, and when, particularly when I've looked at how the Big Four have measured a lot of these parts, is they measure the performance of the individual. They don't measure what I would call the black hole of the collective. How much chaos does that person create by their influence and coming into the place, and all the other people having to tell them where the toilet is, where the printer is, this is how you do this. It's like it sucks in everything around them. And then, you know, 2 years later, when this guy's made changes and they say, well, hang on, why can't we go back to how things were? They get being accused of, because they won't get on the bus, they get accused of being the cancer. And so they, you know, I think you lose probably 30% of your staff sometimes in that kind of way, which is the change upon change upon change. And then they say, you know what, I'm done with this, I'm off. And then they go. So it can't ever be measured immediately. All these things have to be measured as a chain and a collective. If you make a change in rugby, it won't stop messing with you for 8 years. We're still being messed with now by decisions made in rugby in Australia in the 2000s. They're still affecting us now. So you can't just look at all the decisions of this CEO. You have to look at all the collective decisions of everybody along that chain of events and what that does to the organization. I mean, they talk about Boeing still being affected now by the McDonnell Douglas acquisition, which was, what, the 1990s.
And there's a fascinating video that your company, Gainline Analytics, put together about the situation in Australian rugby. I'll put it in the show notes for everybody to have a look at. It's fascinating, and it challenges the way that you do think about teams and expansion and investment and growth. But Ben, it's been super to spend 45 minutes with you. They are fantastic ideas. They are challenging. They are different. They are innovative. There's plenty of food for thought there. And we appreciate you sharing so much of your insight with us, even if you wouldn't tell us what that KPI was.
I mean, 10 years is an easy one. Thank you very much. I would say, like, I think, one, it's a great pleasure to speak with you. And secondly, you know, whenever we sit down with people and talk to them, particularly coaches, for example, different environments, our work does not suit everyone, because oftentimes I remember we talked to a coach and said, to be honest with you, probably didn't win as many titles as you should have. You know, he did not respond to that very well, because his view of himself is he's the genius, he's the leader, he's the one who creates his success. Mm. So it doesn't always sit well, but that doesn't mean we're wrong. It maybe means we're barking up the right tree in terms of trying to understand performance.
Thank you, Ben. It's been a complete masterclass in cohesion. It's a term that I hear a lot of coaches use, along with chemistry and connection and a whole others. But I think you've really unpacked cohesion for us today and given us some really simple ideas that people can take into their own teams starting tomorrow. So thank you very much, and all the best for that research you're doing on the Jets.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Great Coaches Podcast.
So, Eric, that was very different from what you would normally expect. Some very interesting ideas there that run counter to a lot of the mainstream thoughts. I mean, so many points. I wrote down here this idea of stress being an outcome of ambiguity.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, so absolutely, stress, I think, is elevated when with ambiguous situations. I mean, in organizations, sometimes leaders pursue ambiguity strategically because they use that ambiguity to create a set of options for themselves or to create alternatives. So in a way, I think one of the underlying elements in what Ben is talking about is that organizations are geared towards optimizing functions. But actually, one of the kind of dark sides of this might be, you know, there are instances where people are using bluff or ambiguity to actually buy themselves time, buy themselves options, not optimize. And so I think it's a very interesting dynamic to think about, for sure.
What were some of the other key points from Ben that challenged some of your beliefs going in?
I mean, I don't know if they challenged them or if they sort of synced, but I thought his point about succession planning was interesting. I mean, you know, there is a part of succession planning, whether that be at the CEO level or, you know, at management level, where people like to do broad area searches, you know, the idea that we're open to global talent, think about different things. And I think, you know, it sounds like Ben would come down on the side of internal search and development of talent to kind of build that team cohesion through the organization. And I'm certainly partial to that, I have to say. I mean, it's probably not how everyone thinks about things, but, you know, when I think about great organizations that have had long-lived tenures in their leadership, they often, you know, build their future leaders from within. And I think that's I think it's an exciting thing. I think it's rewarding for staff. And it's probably a little bit controversial in some respects. But I thought that was an interesting idea.
I liked this idea that Ben had around understanding each other having more impact than the size of the population that you're pulling from. And I was thinking while he was talking about the Iceland soccer team that have done, you know, so well in the last decade at the Euros and even at the World Cup for a nation of just 300 people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably differentiating between the physical and the mental components of thinking about performance. I mean, you know, physically, a larger population is going to give you more variance, you know, larger numbers in particular, characteristics and attributes. So that makes sense. I think what Ben is tuning into is all of that matters to some degree, but it's that mental connection. It's the intellectual cohesion that is just as, if not more important. In that respect, I think, you know, it comes less from demographic drivers and more from how you build the team. So I think, you know, his point is keep with the existing team, keep going, build up experience, build up repeat exposure to the same kinds of challenges so that you learn and get better next time you face the same circumstance. So I think that's a very interesting concept. The other idea that jumped out to me was your question around how do we think about innovation when we're building teams to be consistent and cohesive? And, you know, I think one of the things to think about there is the way in which organizations build meta routines. You know, in the management literature, we often think about, you know, how do you build new product development? How do you build new venture creation? There's actually a pretty tried and tested way for putting yourself outside your comfort zone, prototyping and developing a kind of construct and then testing it. And so I do think there's a way in which organizations need to build the capabilities to take risk. And that is actually a tried and tested process that organizations need to get better at over time, the more experienced they are at taking on risk and trying new things.
I also thought, listening to him, that innovation could evolve to almost be a service. And, you know, if you're focusing on high cohesion to deal with volatility and changes in the environment, you could actually start to say, well, we're going to look outside for innovation. We're going to have processes and systems and routines we use to bring that outside thinking in, which I know some companies do. I know, for instance, Procter & Gamble are a big believer in, also a very highly cohesive company. They only promote from within and they start to look externally for their innovation ideas.
Yeah, and I think the key making that work, as I've reflected on that and thought about instances of this myself, is that when you're making the decision to start, you're clear on how you make the decision to stop and politics doesn't get in the way. So, you know, this idea, which is a dud, isn't going to continue by virtue of this powerful person X having put it forward. Because I think it's when those kinds of rationales are used to justify decisions that it gets problematic. So the discipline there, I think, is being super clear on what success is, defining it, measuring it, and being able to make decisions around that, irrespective of the individuals or personalities that might be involved in the organization. And that's a difficult thing to do, I think.
And Eric, the idea at the end there around learning versus unlearning was also quite timely and very challenging as well. What do you talk about at the university when it comes to this idea of unlearning at a speed which is comparable to the rate of change that you're experiencing around you?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, learning and unlearning are two sides of the same coin. When you learn something, you're also learning you learn something, you're working out what works and what doesn't work. So it's how do you stop the thing that doesn't work and try something different. So, you know, that's why I think it's two sides of the same coin. I think the key thing there is to make sure that you've got a discipline around that reflection, a discipline around working out, okay, has this experience improved or has it diminished performance relative to the last time I did this?
Eric, thank you for today. A fascinating discussion with Ben. Lots to talk about, lots to think about. I appreciate your input today and I'll see you for our next interview in a week or so.
Sounds great, Paul. Looking forward to it.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.